Hey folks, thanks for tuning in to the BAMF podcast, our writer's chat on Thursday. With us today is a very special guest star, Mr. Owen Casey Stevens. How you doing, Owen?
Hi folks. Good. I'm doing okay.
Yeah, thanks for showing up. So anyone who doesn't know, Owen was the main developer of Starfinder. Also did the Star Wars RPG for Wizards of the Coast, also did the Black Company RPG back in the day. I've been in the industry a long time.
And on all those projects, there were lots of other people. Don't give me more credit than I've got coming.
Understood. Very, very humble man. And before I jump into introducing co-hosts, let me show off this incredibly high production value intro music we have. 1 second.
You know, I'm pretty sure I could talk legendary game designer James M. Ward into using some footage of him dancing.
That would be awesome.
To go with that?
That's what TikTok is all about, baby. We can get that TikTok money.
We'd have to call that dance the Metamorphosis Alpha.
Yes, yes, absolutely. He plays on a Friday game that we run for a couple of authors, and when we do the intro music in the beginning, he's like, and I'm just geeking out the whole time. Like, this is the greatest thing ever.
Nice. Introducing co-hosts, directly beneath me in the Brady Bunch grid is Mr. Ryan M. Danks, aspiring fiction writer, writes on Medium, and probably best known for J-Punk. How you doing, sir?
Good. How are you?
All right. How was life in Vegas today?
Hot. Right,
that makes sense. Up in Colorado, we just had snow like 5 days ago. So.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. And last but not least, over here in the corner is Walt Rebelliard of Hazard Studios, and soon to be publishing a trilogy of science fiction novels coming out in the very near future. How are you doing, sir?
Oh, so much work. I got to tell you, though, ghostwriting, so many projects. It's crazy.
So how do you get the head to not be on fire when you're done with those gigs?
As far as what?
it was a marvel. Joke, sorry. Remember Ghost Rider?
Oh, Ghost Rider. Yeah, yeah. Oh, now I get it.
Yeah.
I thought you were talking like, you know, like my head exploded because, you know, I don't know what project to take next.
No, man, Ghost Rider, got the motorcycle, flaming head.
You know, I got to tell you, lately, I'm more of a Robbie Reyes guy. I really love that character. I love, you know, that new, fresh take on it. And every time he revs up the car and the flames come off the hood, I'm like, this is the greatest thing ever.
That's the worst Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., right?
Yes.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, and in the comics, it's very similar. Very similar origin, very similar feel. And he's just a really fun take on Ghost Rider. So, you know, he's not so like, woe is me, I'm trapped in this. It's more like, I have this ability, and though a lot of it sucks, I can still do a lot of good with it. So it's fun.
Well, it's the aughts, right? It's time to move past grim and gritty superheroes of so 20 years ago.
Now it's Snyderverse that.
Yeah, well, yeah, fair enough. Yeah. Whole other subject for another day. Right. So since all of us have ties to RPGs, we've been getting requests from listeners to talk about adventure design, adventure writing. And Owen was kind enough to come on and give us his advice, his guidance on that. So, Owen, without further ado, I'll just hand the microphone over to you if you want to take over.
Sure. So there are a couple of key things, in my opinion. The first is keep firmly in mind what you are writing this adventure for. And what I mean is, I love writing adventures to run for my friends or run at a convention where all I need are enough notes and stats for me to know what happens during the adventure, right? I have a few handouts, a few maps, I'm good to go. I kind of hate writing adventures for publication because after I get past that enough notes and handouts and maps that I can run it, the rest for me is boring. But it's really important when you're doing professional game design for other people to fill in all those details that, you know, you can't put your head your brain in the envelope with the rest of the adventure. So you need to think about, well, what if someone acts differently from my gaming group? And what is the actual background? And what do I want to give the GM advice if they people go screaming off the rails? So I see two common mistakes here. One is for people to literally try and write every single word that you would need for a published adventure, even for stuff that they're just going to do at home. And the other is for people that have run, they're great game master and they run lots of cool adventures that they homebrew, and then they try and publish them, and all it is a slightly beefed up version of those notes. And you really need, you need to make sure that you can hand that adventure to someone else, and then without you ever saying another thing to them, they can successfully run it. So know why you're writing it is important. The other thing I see people make the biggest mistake on, from my point of view, is a lot of people try and write adventures in the same order they would encounter them if they were a player. So I want to write, you know, the scene at the tavern where you pick up the adventure or whatever. And then the first, and that makes sense because that's how you're used to encountering adventures. But for me, it is much easier to write an adventure backwards. Start with, what do I want the wrap up of this adventure to be? What's the climax? What's the goal? What are the stakes? And then reverse engineer how to get there. Because if I'm writing forwards, it's really easy to do the beginning of an adventure in the middle of an adventure and then not know how to end it. I've got all these hints and clues that I've written and I don't know where they're going. Whereas if I decide, oh, this is an adventure set in a weird Wild West setting with magic and aliens, and at the end you're going to run into a Martian lich running a magic tripod that is trying to send people literally to hell in the Badlands. That, as a set piece, as the end, makes it easy for me to come in and start dribbling clues as I work backwards. Okay, when do you know that he's an undead? Okay, when do you discover it's also a Martian? Okay, what are people that have seen this tripod walking over the moors describing, right? What do they say to the players so that you can more easily build towards that end state?
Now, what's some of the things that you've seen some people do right that you were like, hey, that's neat?
I really like little tiny sidebars that give information to the GM that might or might not come up, or advice on how to handle sets of things, right? It is impossible, whether you're doing a firmly on the rails railroad adventure or a more broad sandbox, it is impossible to cover everything that players might do. So, like, if you're trying to do an adventure that happens to stop by a city, but that's it, you're just stopping by and moving on, to have a little sidebar there saying, hey, players tend to go crazy in cities. They may want to buy equipment and talk to people. And if you're writing for a game line, you can say, okay, feel free to go look at this other product that has a great city in it and borrow from it. Or if you're doing it from home, you can just make a note for yourself. Hey, I have a city. There happen to be some necromancers. I'm going to have a copy of Hollowfast from Scarred Lands available nearby so I can borrow it for shops and stores or whatever. I'm also a big fan of things like random charts. There was a big debate in Paizo when I was working on modules there whether we still wanted to have random monster encounters set in any adventure. But one of the advantages of them is, even if people don't use them randomly, if you say, here are a series of things that people might run into in the area, you're actually giving information about the area, right? If I'm looking at an adventure and it says your random encounters may include dinosaurs, Martians, gunslingers with cursed bullets, and wolverines, that gives a very different feel than if it says your random encounters may include orcs and dragons and bandits. And it helps set a tone in a very small word count while also directing people to usable game mechanical stats.
You know, I got to tell you, that first random table, I'm all about that game. That needs to happen right now.
So that is pretty much a random table from my really Wild West setting. I mean, in my most recent adventure, right, a centaur paladin literally used a smite evil power on the teetering car of a freight train to drop it on an undead dinosaur. So she smote a dinosaur with a train car by pushing it off a bridge and declaring it to be an improvised weapon.
That's how I love you that do campaign. It, damn it. Oh my yeah. God.
There was much cheering. Oh, Ryan, are you awesome. Muted? I didn't hear you.
Yeah, Ryan, we're not getting you.
Yeah, no audio, sir.
Lo siento, amigo. So where, like when you see ideas that like, you know, prompt the smite evil train, which is just fantastic. How do you take those ideas and incorporate them into your own designs without blatantly ripping them off?
I mean, first of all, I think homage is a thing, right? There is nothing wrong with saying, hey, I just watched Aliens, and even though my group are more Black Company-esque fantasy mercenaries, I want to do an Aliens-like thing with fiendish ants that have a giant ant colony that have broken into a series of halfling homes, and the halfling colonists are glued up to the wall and have ant eggs implanted in them. That is a very clear homage, right? That's where people go, oh, I see what you've done there. But you file the serial numbers up and you put a 90-degree turn on it, and suddenly it's acidic spraying ants instead of acidic blooded aliens, and that can make all the difference. Can we hear you now?
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you now. Great.
Okay.
There you go.
The other thing is that we assure that the next thing you say will be just as important, so we're glad that we will be able to hear it. The other thing is that I frequently don't try and force things, right? Like, I literally, as the game master, did not set things up with the intent of someone dropping a rail car on an undead dinosaur. I just set up a fight on a trellis bridge that had a train on it that had been overrun by undead dinosaurs. And to make things interesting, since I thought the fight would occur on the train cars, I had one of them teetering right on the edge. But the players knew there was a bigger undead dinosaur, so they lured it into the valley below them and dropped a train car on it. I could not reasonably set up an adventure to say the correct solution here is to drop a train car on the undead dinosaur. That would be way too, if you'll pardon the term in this case, on the railroad tracks, right? Driving into this is the only solution. But I think a lot of good adventure design is to include interesting elements and then see what the players do with it. I do a lot of fantasy age development. I'm the fantasy age developer for Green Ronin right now. And we did a product called Layers, which has a lot of special game mechanics set up for monster layers. So we'll say, hey, here's a dragon. Here's its lair. There's oil everywhere in this area, so the dragon can set it on fire. That's a special circumstance that can show up. We call them stunts. We have stunt points. So you can do things like say, hey, the pirate ship has sails. Here are rules for sliding down them. Or there's a giant chandelier in the evil sheriff's of Nottingham's big banquet hall, and the rope holding it over here, and you can drop it on people. And you don't try to say the solution to this adventure is to drop the chandelier on the sheriff. You just say, here's a chandelier. Here are some trestle tables. There's a roast pig on a spit in the fireplace. And when you set those elements out, you leave it up to the GM and the players to decide what are they going to do with it.
Yeah, I saw some on Twitter recently talking about the advantages of a loose GMing style. I think it kind of goes towards the advantages of running a sandbox type of, you know, adventure, in that you prepare the elements. You don't have a plot you're trying to, you know, move. You just kind of do a lot of improv and yes and to get from point A to point B. Now, that way it doesn't feel like you're writing a whole screenplay every couple weeks and then, you know, trying to act it out every Friday night.
Well, and if I'm working on a sandbox or a homebrew setting, I also tend to like to let the players lead me, right? So if I say, hey, here's a city, most of it is bright and shiny, but there's one creepy tower, and there happens to be a tavern that is run by a friendly goblin bartender, and there are rumors of bandit attacks out in the forests, and I figure, I just said there's a giant creepy tower, the players will immediately go to that, and instead they say, ooh, what kind of bandits? Can we get ourselves hired on as mercenary guards for a caravan? Can we look into, are the bandit attacks all being driven by one guy? And I can go, okay, these are the questions they're asking me this session. So I will tell them, yeah, you can absolutely do those things. We'll talk about it next week, next 2 weeks, whatever. And then I'll get that ready. And if I want something to happen in the tower, I'll just hold on to that for later. The other thing is that for me, nothing is wasted, right? One of my favorite stories. I ran an adventure for over a decade called The Sovereign Kingdoms. And I had this idea for the Waters of Life as a sort of relic. And in like the second or third session of the game, one of the characters was given a vial of the Waters of Life to protect because I was going to do something with it later. And I forgot. I just totally forgot I'd already handed that out. Never came up. Literally a decade of real time later, we've been playing with the same people for over 10 years. And I have this huge adventure set up that's going to be a quest to get a vial of the Waters of Life. And I've got a castle with guardians and there are going to be places to go. And a different player's character is told, yes, you can speak to the ancient sage in order to find out the solution to your problem, but only if you get a vial of the Waters of Life. They're otherwise too weak in order to do anything. And so that player was the player who takes notes. If it had been any other player, I might have been fine. The player I'd given the vial to the Waters of Life had forgotten they had them. But the player who takes notes was like, okay, so there's this legendary artifact, and if I go get it, I can talk to the sage. Great. Goes outside, says to the player that has it, hey, do you still have those Waters of Life that we got 10 years ago in real time? And the player was like, what Waters of what? Oh, here it is on my character sheet. Yeah, I do. Can I borrow that? Sure, they said for something important. This seems important. Handed it to him, walks back in. Here you go. So I have an entire adventure I've set up to get this. And it's just been short-circuited in 2 minutes. But nothing goes to waste. They just said, okay, now we can talk to the sage and say, how can we get rid of this major enemy? And he says, okay, you can do it. You can totally do it. You just need the sword that will slay him. Which it turns out will be in this castle with these guardians at the end of this long quest. And I just took that material I'd prepped, took out the MacGuffin that they were supposed to go for, put in the new one, and moved forward. I personally, when I'm writing adventures, I never want to punish players for being smart or creative, right? You remembered something I forgot. Not only that, but I made a big deal out of it, right? The Guardians of the Sage were like, wait a minute, we told you to get this legendary thing and it took you all of an hour? Yes, we will absolutely let you see the Sage. Can we hold your cape? Can we do anything else for you? Can we contact you if we have other problems? Because this is supposed to be escapism, and having to overcome things is an important part of that. But if the players have reasonably done something smart or lucky or dumb and it worked, what, you know, knocking a giant freight car onto an undead dinosaur is arguably dumb. But if they do those things, I want to reward them. That's the whole point of the adventure. And when you do that, it also means that if they do something reasonable and smart, but they have misinterpreted what's going on or they roll terribly, it doesn't sting as much because it doesn't feel like you as the GM are out to get them. You're like, oh yeah, that was perfect. You were targeting the healer. That makes perfect sense. You were trying to take out the enemy, but it turns out that you missed that he had invisible guardians. There were all these hints. You didn't see it. And now they are going to beat you to a pulp. In my experience, if the players know when we're smart or lucky, we're rewarded. When we're unlucky or we do something dumb, it doesn't hurt as much. So I really like to set up elements and let the chips fall where they may.
Now, can I ask your opinion on an approach I've been trying recently?
Sure, absolutely.
I write mainly supers adventures because I'm masochistic. And I got to thinking, I get tired of, you know, trying to account for every single possibility because there's a million of them in that kind of a genre. So I will include like 5 to 7 sample characters in the back of the adventure. Say it's written for these guys. If you're running it with him, here's my advice. Other than that, I don't give a lot of guidance except, you know, if your guys are too strong, increase the attacks by this much. If you have a psychic, give, you know, every fifth henchman psychic proof headgear and, you know, just kind of let it run that way and, you know, figure that the people who want to run with pregens, you have the pregens. Otherwise, your GM will be smart enough to figure out what to do. So,
yeah, that's a perfectly reasonable approach. But it also automatically leans into another useful thing I think it's worth talking about for adventure design. And that is think about what players can do. It is very normal in writing an adventure to think about, you know, your favorite fantasy movie or whatever. Think about what players are actually capable of. Again, in my Really Wild West game, there happens to be one character who can both speak with the dead and speak with animals. And so it came up, hey, can I speak to this dead cow to figure out what killed it? The rules don't say specifically, but if you can both speak to dead things and you can speak to animals, speaking to dead animals seems like a reasonable extension. So anytime you are putting together something, an adventure, like, hey, there's a cow here and it is obviously been mutilated, I like to give the GM the baseline information. Although it was mutilated and it is extremely difficult to tell, it was killed by the monster in scene 5. And once I do that, the GM has that information. So if players come up and they're like, hey, we've added this character from the supplement who can travel through time, so he's going to travel backwards to time to see what the cow's done, the GM at least has those tools. Oh, you've told them not only what the players are seeing, but why, even if we don't know how the GMs would find that information. If people can fly, if people can teleport, that can change an adventure pretty significantly. And so when you're writing an adventure with pregens, you have the advantage that you're like, okay, I'm going to make 7 pregen characters. Obviously, you're going to want them to represent a range of options. So you may think, okay, I've created a psychic and I've created a flying brick and I've created a guy that turns on fire and I've created a billionaire in powered armor. And then when you do that, you come to an encounter, you might think to yourself, well, I've made this character a billionaire. Can this problem be solved by just offering someone $10,000? Because if so, that billion character might do that. And so you can have that in the back of your mind. Oh, here are the things that might happen. So you can address the most common and most reasonable abilities of various characters.
Cool. Hey, we have a question from one of our commenters, Jason Sunday. And I'll do the one voice I use for commenters. How do you balance giving the GM enough information for the adventure and too much that makes the story too worried, wordy? And that's from Jason Sunday, who actually plays RPGs with us here on noon mountain time on Mondays. So thank you, Jason.
That's a great question. And the real answer is carefully, which isn't particularly useful. I wrote an adventure in a series of adventures called Heart of the Razor, which were for the Razor Coast. And that had a ton of backstory. And the way I did it with that adventure was I wrote the backstory once, but I numbered the paragraphs. And so if the GM read the backstory, this is how we got to the adventure. And then later they ran into an NPC that knew some of the things that happened. I could say this NPC is familiar with the things that happened in paragraphs 2 through 5. And the GM can just go back and look, oh, I had to read the backstory. Because of a lot of adventures start with, how did we get here, right? You know, it's like if you're running an adventure that's Lord of the Rings, you got to say, hey, Sauron made these rings, and then he was turned into a giant eye, and there's a guy named Gollum running around. Even just that can get pretty wordy. But try and make it as concise and in one place as possible. So if you're introducing a monster that's wandering around mutilating cattle, at the beginning, you can say, hey, there's a monster. This is where the monster came from. These are the monster's goals. It's done the following things. Keep it concise and short. And then when you run into cattle, you can just say, this is one of the cattle that the monster mutilated. And you don't have to explain everything again. That also, keeping information in as few places as possible, makes it easy for the GM to find it. One of the advantages to the here's the full backstory and we just refer back to it is the GM isn't found going, oh, there was something about cattle. Is it with the cattle encounter? No. Is it with the monster? No. Is it in the angry rancher that's hiring you? No. So organization can make something that seems wordy a lot easier to get into. At the same time, know your audience, right? If you're talking about a professional adventure, look and see what their style is. Some people, like, say, Paizo, they tend to have several pages of backstory explaining where the adventure came from. And if you read that, the rest of the adventure makes sense. Other people try and put each bit of information in the encounter where you're most likely to run it. And that works great if these things are fairly discreet. If it's a dungeon and there's no overarching plot and it's just Caverns of Chaos and every room has its own monster in it and they may have a goal and that is not relevant anywhere else, you can take that information and put it in this room. There are 5 orcs. They have 2 pies. They have lived here for 5 generations. They will kill anyone that looks at their pie. And you just stop. That's all you need to know there. And in the next room, there are goblins and they happen to have a tiramisu. And if there is not, in fact, a magic baker in the back passing out desserts as part of his evil plan to win them all over, that's all you need to cover.
I think Owen needs to write us this dungeon now because I want to see the evil baker who's keeping everyone in line with
instead of the Caverns of Chaos, it would be the Desert of Dessert.
Exactly. Mr. Ryan, thanks. You've been very quiet today, sir. You have any questions, comments, thoughts?
No, I think we My professional experience in writing adventure modules is to make an outline and then give it to Benjamin Feehan to write it. But but we have similar play styles. The way, because mine would never would get published. The way that I play is I come up with a question. Can Spider-Man defeat Doc Ock? Whatever. What's the question? The PCs, can they do whatever? I pose that question as early as possible. I have a few ideas of how it can be answered, but I really buy into the shared storytelling thing that I thought Fate Core had said, and then I found out I coined it. I wasn't sure. But it's where it's not my story, it's the table story. And so I like to ask a question and then help them answer it. And so my adventure modules are, or my adventure notes are usually half a page, because it's the question and then some villains that are relevant to the question, which sounds like how similar to how Owen probably plays on his own when he's not writing.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, I most of my play at the moment is with people that I have literally been playing role-playing games with for 30 years, right? So there are certain things I can be reasonably sure they will and won't do. I made up a new monster called Rattle Cats, which were pumas with rattlesnake tails and venomous bites. And I had in my notes here, why are these things stalking the players and what will it take to convince them to not attack them? Because I knew one of the characters could talk to animals, and I knew these players, they're not looking for a fight. They are looking for a solution. And they will absolutely, if they can talk their way out of an encounter and be happy with the end result, they'll do that. And they tend to cut wild animals a whole lot more slack than bandits. If a bandit takes a pot shot at them, in general, the reaction is, well, that's a sentient sapient creature that decided to try and kill me. His time is over. But if all the bandits happen to mention that they look hungry, they might actually let a few people take pot shots at them while calling out, hey, 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 whoa, 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 what's up? What's the problem? You guys want some coffee? So that is very helpful when building adventures. And you can't necessarily, when you're trying to do it for a published adventure, you can't necessarily do that. But I do think having a sentence on motivation can give the GM a lot of help, right? If you say, hey, here are 12 bandits that are part of the Church of Felony that believe committing crimes will let them be lords in hell, and therefore they are religious zealots. Thank you. Therefore, they are religious zealots dedicated to committing crime, and you can't talk them out of it. That is a very helpful note to a GM compared to, here are 12 bandits who were driven out of their home, and there's a drought, and they're trying to feed their children back at the camp. You can have exactly the same stat blocks, but even just that one sentence gives the GM a very, very different approach to how to run those if things don't go the way that you might expect.
I really like that. I noticed,
No, Brian, go ahead.
I noticed Sparky was mentioning he likes the sandbox games in the previous comment. I'm actually running my first sandbox game, and I'm loving it because you can pepper the... I treat it like an MMO. Like, you know, you can go collect 10 with this dude if you want. I'm going to hide the fact that we're collecting 10, but, you know, that's the idea. But what I do is I just throw a bunch of story questions in there. Like, there's a cave over there as you guys are walking past. What's in it? Oh, do you guys want to look? No. And then all I have to do is at the end of every session, they're either at a campfire or at a tavern. Every session ends that way. And it's like, okay, you guys are discussing. What do you want to do next for next week? So that I know and I can plan something and ask a question. Yep. But I've asked so many questions. They have this massive notes and they're like, this seemed interesting. We want to find out what's up with those bandits of the Church of the Felony. That's so cool.
Thank you.
So, you know, that's like, I'm just like, okay, cool. That's a question we're going to answer. Next week, I'll come up with some potential answers and see what you guys want.
The other great way of doing that is that sometimes the players will come up with a much cooler thing than you ever would have thought of, right? There's a cave. What's in it? Do you want to look? No. You go along for a while. Then you're like, wow, a whole bunch of crimes have been committed here. They're all in a big circle around that cave we didn't look into. That cave must have something to do with all this. And you're like, well, it does now. Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah. I had my first session, I had 5 questions I was going to pose. I was able to pose 3 of them, and they had 10 questions written down because they started looking into things or making things happen. It was great because yep. I was so little planning. I love it.
I do find frequently that there is a certain minimum amount of notes I need to run a game, and I either need to write those notes in advance or I need to make sure I take notes as the players do things and come up with stuff. So knowing a little bit about your own note-taking can be useful. As it happens with my key group, I'm super fortunate in that two of my players like taking notes, and they take them on laptop now, so they will take their notes, and I'll say, hey, will you send those to me just so I know what you kept track of? So I know what, so I can look at and play off their notes. And I also happen to frequently get blog entries out of their notes, which is a great way to get cheap content to put out to people that read my blog.
That's cool. I like that.
Got another question from Mr. Sunday. How do you handle creating text for map locations? Do you draw out a map and use it to write the text, or do you write text and then find a map that fits it, etc.?
I do all these things. So the current game I'm running the most often is set in a fantasy steampunk magic and Martians and weird tech version of 1891. So I literally use a real world map. I just pull it up on Google and I say, hey, you're currently here and I'm going there. And if I know where you're going, I will, do a little research, right? Like I discovered that, one of the cities that they're currently in used to be called Hell's Gate. That was the name of it in 1891. Well, now that I know that I've got a map of a place that used to be called Hell's Gate, I can lead them to Hell's Gate, and I know what the actual map there is. I can use real-world history. At one point, I was like, okay, so you'll be going on your way to Hell's Gate. You're going through this and this, and you'll go right by Tomb Spider because it was on the real-world map. And they were like, wait a minute. There's a place called Tomb Spider? And I'm like, yeah, the real world, Tomb Spider, right there. All right, well, we're going to go check in on Tomb Spider and find out why it's called Tomb Spider. And I'm like, that's a totally reasonable question. Let me, and I'm not satisfied with the real world answer, so it's a fantasy game. I make one up. So one of the things I frequently do is make a map, take a real world map, do some research, and make things up that fit. The other thing that you can certainly do is sketch out a map. And if you're talking about just for your own home games, I mean, you can use Inkarnate, or there are a lot of map programs out there, but there are also some random map generators, which can be fun. And there are even things like there's a whole group of people that take states of the United States and make maps of them, like the Lord of the Rings Tolkien maps. They do it in that style. So I don't think there's any right answer for maps. When it comes to like a location, I will frequently go look at Dyson Logos, who has a whole bunch of commercially available free maps. And I have done adventures just because I'm like, well, I can print this out and hand it to the players, and it's a cool looking map, so I'll just use that. I think any of those are good solutions. When it comes to a professional product, I always want to either use a map that game company is already doing, or sketch it out and send it to a professional cartographer, because I obviously don't want to be borrowing other people's intellectual property for use in a published product.
Yeah, the way I usually do it is not for publishing, but I'll take something like Faerun or something, a place I like, Daggerford, and I'll sketch out the area roughly, and I'll rename it, and everyone thinks I'm a genius. And then from there, I use the dungeon world method of draw maps and see what happens. So like, I just, here's the city, here's the start of Crown City or whatever. I use that a lot. And then from there, we go off and they say they want to see the forests of the north, enchanted forests. Okay, they exist. Well, I'll just draw them up here. And eventually the map looks totally different. But I'll start with something published usually for a home game. I don't publish adventure modules. So.
Right. No. But yeah, I mean, look at what tools you have available. I started a campaign in 15 minutes by putting together a Mad Libs template of what the interesting places nearby were. So I would just say something to do with naval travel, some sort of body of water, and that gave me the Sextant Sea, because I asked the players, you know, tell me something that has to do with naval travel, and someone said Sextant. So suddenly the Sextant Sea is a place in this world, and once I had interesting places, I just take a piece of line paper or grid paper, put some X's, put some names in, and then you fill it in as you go. I think it's very useful to look at what resources you have available. I mentioned like borrowing Hollowfaust, right, from Scarred Lands. If you've got, there are a lot of gamers that have, you know, here are my five bookshelves of stuff, and we don't play this game anymore. But I've got all these books of maps of this world. So take one and you can rename everything. Or if people don't recognize it, you can just say, hey, here's the campaign world, because I've got a map and I've got the place names, but I will change everything to make it like what I want. Do as little work as you can as a GM to get things going.
Cool. Another question from Jason. I'm up slow off the line. What is your method for making villains that players love to hate?
If I make players love to hate them enough, they don't last long if they are on screen. So the best method I personally have found is make sure that the players know that the villain has done something that they disapprove of, and they find that out before they actually meet the villain. One of my greatest villains that the players just loathed was a Minotaur spellcaster named Cantor Maiseborn. And the reason they loathed him is that he was a adventuring villain. He was out doing stuff. So they would come to a town and they're like, what happened here? It's been burned to the ground. And they're like, well, there's this Minotaur with this scrollwork mazes on his horns. And he had these hobgoblin mercenaries and his name was Cantor Maiseborn. And they're like, well, he sounds like a real jerk. We don't like him, but he wasn't there. So they can't kill him immediately. And then they go to another place and they're like, yeah, he broke into our catacombs and he stole all of our holy texts and ripped the maps out of them. And the player's like, well, now we know he's up to something and we don't know where he is and we've got to stop him. And then you're like, the only other copies of those books are in this other cathedral. So they go to that cathedral and there they are attacked by spellcasting hobgoblins who work for Cantor Maiseborn. So you can build up in their mind, you know, Luke didn't face Vader in Star Wars except briefly in the fight scene, but Vader was around doing stuff so that you could have this powerful villain who's successfully doing things when the players aren't on screen with him. And that is easier said than done in various genres, right? Like in a modern genre, they might well be like, well, Dr. Doom lives in Latveria. We'll just sit down and we'll fly out there and we'll deal with him. The other thing that I have done successfully, though it is much trickier, is to make a villain someone that you cannot, for whatever reason, just beat up or kill. So for the Dr. Doom example, Dr. Doom's in Latveria. He's done some stuff and we hate him. Oh, but he has diplomatic immunity. We can't attack Latveria without starting a war. The United Nations won't be on our side. And if he's here in the U.S., he has diplomatic immunity because he is the sovereign ruler of this nation. And that doesn't apply if he commits a crime himself. Oh, but he has Doombots. So a Doombot might attack and he might say, oh, I obviously didn't build that. That's a false flag operation. Someone trying to make me look bad. So the heroes know he's a bad guy. We don't like him. He's working against us. But there's some reason that they can't just go put a fist in his face. You got to be careful with that because, as I said, this is for me, gaming is mostly escapism, and it can be very frustrating to have a villain that you can't do anything about. You can also do things like, you know, the crime kingpin is in jail. You can hate him, but he's already in jail, and what he's doing are not crimes that you get to kill him for. Yeah, Jason Sunday said Lex Luthor. Lex Luthor hides his criminal activity so that you can't beat him up without looking like the bad guy. He was the president at one point. Although no one would believe a major tycoon of industry being a bad guy and also being president while half the country believes him every time he lies. That's just totally unrealistic and no one would buy it. I also at one point had a villain who was known as the Librarian, who was a very, very evil lich, who was very, very, very smart, and had realized that if you are evil in that world, heroes will come kill you. So he got the protection of a powerful emperor to be that emperor's librarian. And as long as the lich, the librarian, did not break the law, no one was allowed to hurt him. So everyone knew he's there and he's evil and he's planning world domination. But for the moment, he's keeping track of the ancient and dangerous books that would kill you if you look at it. It's just not a problem for him. So the players were always watching and going, as soon as he steps over that line, the split second he does something, we're on him. So they hated that villain, even though he was, during the time frame of the campaign, not doing anything villainous. He was just very upfront about, yes, sometime a few thousand years from now, when all you meat puppets are dead, I will have successfully prepared myself to take over the world. But that's not illegal to think about, and I'm not planning anything right now, so I'm in the green.
Nice, nice. Walt. Oh, hey, Ron Fraser saying, I'm late to this, but it sounds so good. Owen is the man. Well, thank you, Ron. Always good to see you there, sir.
Thanks, Ron.
Well, love seeing Ron.
Ron is a good guy. Walt, you've been kind of quiet this episode, too. You got any thoughts, questions?
Well, I was going to say, what happens, how do you factor in a lot of the times the dice mechanic? Because you see some of the, like the early adventures back in the day, it was like, this is the one way you have to open this puzzle or defeat this thing. And, you know, you must, you know, accommodate the one thing in order to do blah, 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 blah. Right. And then, you know, fast forward to game day and it's like, yeah, I don't make my thief roll or I don't do this or I don't do that. Well, how has modern game design kind of evolved so that there's, you know, like, because we've all, like a bunch of us have watched that TV show Leverage.
Yeah.
And one of the great things that they do is that there's not just one way to attack a problem. So how does modern game design kind of encounter that? And what can people take away from those kind of lessons?
So some games do a great job of that. Like if you ever want to look at Gumshoe, in Gumshoe, the role-playing game, Robin Laws, pretty much you're not determining whether or not you can do something important. You're determining how long it will take and how much trouble will it be. But if it's important, you will accomplish it. There are other games like, say, both editions of Pathfinder, where failure is just failure, and you can only accommodate that as modern design by making sure that a single failure point doesn't bring the adventure to a screaming halt. When I was an adventure developer at Paizo, one of the first adventures I looked at literally had a great big dungeon that was very important. And there were like five rooms and then a secret door and then the other 50 rooms of the dungeon, 20, maybe, whatever. And if you did not find that secret door, you didn't even have any reason to believe there was more dungeon. So since I was developing that, instead of making that a check, I had, okay, the party went here before you. One of them was killed by an undead and dragged through that secret door. So the players see a blood stain going across the floor to a section of wall. Now, that means they know there's a secret door there. Great. If you successfully disable and find and open the secret door silently, you can surprise the bloodthirsty undead on the other side. If you don't, you can take a Madoc and smash the thing open, but that means that they're ready for you and they're going to have their spells cast up, so it becomes harder. So that means that that success is still relevant. Can I be sneaky? Can I find a secret door? Can I disable a trap? Those skills don't become irrelevant. They have an impact on the adventure, but they don't bring the adventure to a screeching halt. So what I try to do, if the game does not itself have a built-in mechanism for you will always be able to find something else, I try to make sure that the adventure is designed, that there are always other options. The other thing that I think gets forgotten sometimes is unless you're in some sort of organized play with rules or tournament situation, you can always just talk to your players. I was playing in a game recently where we ran into refugees who were coming from a place where a evil force had just taken over their town. And we as players were all like, refugees, evil town takeover, we're going to go there and stop them. And in between that session, which is how it ended, the next session, the game master came to us and said, guys, I did not intend for you to go hurrying off and try and stop this town. It speaks well of all of you as people. It speaks well of your characters, but that's not something I got written up or I'm preparing to do. You reacted more strongly than I expected. Can we walk that back and rewrite that so that you don't feel the need to just go hauling off there and try and save people? So we had a conversation out of character about how to avoid not having fun in the next game session. So you can totally, this is a game. This is not an actual alternate reality with hard rules that can never be changed. If as a player or as a GM, something has gone badly off the rails, sometimes there's a simple fix, right? You didn't find the door that goes through the secret doorway into the rest of the dungeon. You go back, you get attacked by a Cyclops, you kill the Cyclops. The Cyclops has a map that shows the whole dungeon. Okay, now we go back. But there's nothing wrong with saying, guys, I miscalculated. I have a lot more adventure in there. There was a secret door. Do you all mind if we just assume that you all came back and rest, but you knew the secret door was there and you go back in? Just talk to your players, because ultimately, in my experience, yes, it's more satisfying for the game mechanics to cover everything. Sometimes things go south. At my very first 3-0 D&D game, I killed the entire party as the GM because I had no idea how dangerous wolves were. That was it, just wolves. I threw a pack of wolves at the players and killed them all. And at first, the players were all like, well, I guess we all need to make new characters. And I'm like, this is literally the first encounter. I've killed everyone. I'm going to call that a bad on my part. So if you all don't mind, you're just going to all wake up having had a prophetic dream that if you go in there, you're all going to be killed by wolves, and that way you can prepare for it. And they're like, no, I'm totally good with that. That becomes a dream sequence. And then they did things like, well, let's get some wolf traps, and let's get some torches, and let's set more than one person on guard each night. And that became part of the narrative. But we just stepped outside and said, we want to play this game. We don't want to make new characters.
Yeah, that's it. Well, I mean, it's, you're trying to have a good time, right?
And yeah.
The idea is to not be shackled to the game system so much that you can't have a good time. So, and one of some of my earliest role-playing experiences was with a guy who, if you didn't explicitly tell him, I found a stables in town, I boarded my horse for the night, I gave him enough sufficient money for carrots and oats. The next morning, he's like, well, where are your horses? You didn't tell me you boarded them. Bandits rode off with them. Coyotes ate them. You don't have horses anymore. You're walking it, buddy. We're going to be doing a lot more travel encounters. And that was very satisfying for him, but for no one else at the table.
Yeah. Yeah, there are people that enjoy the confrontational GM to player experience. I am not one of them. For me, the GM is there to, it's what Ryan said. There's an interesting story here. I want to help you find it. So yes, I may cackle if I get the players off guard or surprise them, but only in a fair or interesting way. I never want, you know, I'm the GM. I could do anything. Hey, your characters are walking along. The gods don't like the way that your belt is worn. You are all slain. Ha ha ha. I have won Dungeons and Dragons and it was advanced. That's no fun for anyone. So for me, the point of the rules is to form the framework that explains the universe. I actually like pretty crunchy game systems a lot, because for me, the experience of navigating those rules and understanding them and then saying, oh, look, this challenge is, you know, we're fifth level characters. This is a CR9 challenge. We can see that it is more difficult. And then we make the choice to go in there and put ourselves at risk. If we then pull that off, that is more satisfying for me than a lot of storytelling games where, like, okay, describe how you win this encounter and burn three story Benny points and activate two relationships. That's not to say that that is wrong or bad. It's just not as satisfying for me as a player, or really as a GM. That's not to say I don't enjoy those. I played a fair number of those storytelling games, and they're great for me for a one-time experience, just like I may, or a short experience, right? A few sessions. But the campaigns that I played in and run that have lasted decades have been the ones where there is a more crunchy, defining, limiting set of rules. And those form part of the sense that you're overcoming adversity is overcoming the fact that you might roll a one or a D20, or that you only have so many hit points, or, you know, I run out of spells, whatever. That's part of the fun for me, is that negotiation and management of those risks. And I totally accept that there are a lot of people for whom I'm playing the sharpshooter archer, but I can't roll above a 3 on a D20 is more unfun than, hey, I'm playing a peasant and I throw a pitchfork at him and I rolled a 20, unexpected victory. I get that. And there's nothing wrong with being interested in other play styles. That also means that if you are a GM running things at home, know what your game system is and isn't good at, and know what your players are looking for in a game. I make house rules to make a game more like what I and the players want all the time. And you can do a lot by saying things like, hey, you get one free success in one area per game session. It's not in the rules where we're playing Pathfinder First Edition or Rollmaster, an incredibly crunchy game, but I'm still saying once per game session, you get to succeed at a thing in an area of expertise. Each of you pick one, and one person picks attacking and damage, and one person picks spellcasting, and one person picks healing. And then totally outside the rules, we're like, oh, they're bleeding to death. Well, I will try and heal them. Nope, you rolled an 04. Now we go to the critical thumb in the organ table to see how you kill them. Nope, I'm turning in my one expertise, Benny. I succeeded at this check. There's nothing wrong with that if that's what the players and the GM want to do.
maybe that can figure into adventure design and that publication. You got to market it. You may make it clear, this is the tone I'm using for this adventure. If you like to have a character who walks in dual wielding katanas with a, you know, 9mm in his teeth, this isn't the one for you. This is going to be courtly political intrigue and, you know, caviar and, you know, meaningful discussions in back rooms. Conversely, if you like running in dual wielding your katanas while wearing a trench coat, this is exactly the adventure for you. And just, you know, kind of pick your flavor and stick with it in those adventures, because I think you can kill yourself trying to make one adventure that is all things to all players of a particular system.
And just as a caveat, some as somebody who knows how to use a katana sword, please don't do that. Don't wield two at the same time while wearing a trench coat. That is very bad.
No. Rule of cool, Walt. Sorry.
Oh, you totally do it. I'm just going to laugh at you at the results because I know what they are.
I just watched Blade last week, buddy, and it works fine. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, and so that also speaks to tone, right? You could theoretically have a Teenagers from Outer Space scenario that sounded a whole lot like a Mechton scenario, but those two game systems assume very different things about how seriously we're taking this adventure. For a long time, I've heard the term a beer and pretzels game, which is a game where, yes, we are gaming, but the important part is not the game. The important part is that we are together and there's beer or root beer or whatever and pretzels and we're hanging out. And if it turns out that your bard is slaughtered for the 15th time, you'll just slap a new photocopy of that bard on your table and on we go. Versus a game where we all expect to be very, very serious and always in character and no one's ever going to say anything goofy. Some of that is game system, some of that is venture, some of that is play style. I think it's worth the more you give the GM a fairly basic outline of what's going on, the easier it can be for them to change things, right? Even if we're doing a courtly adventure, if we say, hey, this is a courtly adventure, but by the way, if you kill characters A, B, and 5 while wearing a trench coat and carrying two katanas, you can still move to the next scenario. It's not what we had in mind, but if in fact instead of a party at Versailles, this turns out into assault on Versailles, where you're going to kill everyone that will oppose your political machinations, you know, I don't care how the GM and the players use the adventure as long as they're having a good time. So for me, an adventure is always a resource.
And a game like that where beer and pretzels is a lot of fun. Right before the pandemic, we did like an online get together with a whole bunch of dudes and did like John Wick, but the all of the protagonists were like 12-year-olds, and it was all Nerf guns, and they were fighting over the fate of the neighborhood. And it was super fun, and like some of the things people were pulling off, and all the guys in it were all veterans who were all working through issues. They were having a tough time, and they were geeking out. And some of the comments were like, you know, oh my God, I never could have done this, you know, so and so, and you know, this is amazing. You know, I'm immediately going out and getting Nerf guns to try this. So yeah, stuff like that could be a lot of fun.
And also just, you know, with what the point of the adventure session is sometimes.
Sorry about that last comment. I should have read that before I shared it.
was that directed at me?
Yeah.
Do you know Travis Bennett?
I think so.
Okay.
Put it up there. We're not scared.
Put it up there.
Oh, all right. We do have an explicit tag. If any young children in the crowd, please avert your eyes. I will not be reading this.
I'll read it. Ryan, what's good, my baby boy? I told you I would tune in. My legs were literally shaking from the back rub you gave me last week. You were definitely worth the $40.
We can stop. What the?
Okay, maybe I don't know Travis.
What the hell?
Oh, he's not a friend of yours? Are we just getting trolled right now? I feel like we're getting trolled right now.
I think we're getting trolled because that's...
Okay, I know
Travis, but maybe not that one. I don't know. Oh my god! I like if someone requests me on Facebook and it's clearly not a bot, I just friend them back. I don't care. So I don't go on Facebook anyway.
I told you the only reason I go on Twitter is just for you, Ryan. I just go on to see your posts.
I don't go on Twitter anymore
either. Yeah, which is why I haven't been either.
Oh, and I am terribly sorry. We finally get to come back to the podcast.
So you know how we were talking about the tone can be a very important part of...
Apparently, though, for $40, I give a kick-ass back rub.
A back rub.
Well, I mean, as convention season becomes a thing again, that's worth knowing, but...
I might skip.
Although, honestly, for most conventions, your foot rub rate is much more relevant to me than your back rub rate, but... Again, just before the pandemic, I played in a game Malcolm Sheckford ran at OrcaCon that was the Tomb of Horrors in first edition D&D, but we knew we were just there to hang out and have a good time and laugh at the design of the Tomb of Horrors, right? And so he had pre-gen characters that he had just downloaded first edition characters. He made no effort to see if they were balanced or even rules accurate. And I decided that my character was there to lick everything. That was going to be my goal in the Tomb of Horrors, right?
This is my spirit animal.
And well, I don't do spirit animals, but my fuel jet. But anyway, that character did surprisingly well because with one notable exception that we didn't happen to find, touching things in the Tomb of Horrors is how you activate stuff and cause encounters and find secret spaces. And so our attitude was, we don't expect to survive. We hope we die in a hysterical way. We're pretending we're playing paranoia, basically. And several people died, and you just picked up a new pre-gen from the pile. And we did great. We were clearing the dungeon with great alacrity because we didn't care what happened to these characters. That wasn't the point of that evening for us. You can also sometimes simulate those things with an adventure by doing something like saying, hey, you guys can jack into the imaginary internet, or you can have a dream sequence, or you have been summoned up to fight in the gladiatorial pit where you are frozen in time before you step in and you go back to that save point.
Yeah, that's probably the best way to play Tomb of Annihilation, is just have a stack of character sheets and understand that's the kind of world you're in.
Yeah, once again, absolutely.
Tone.
You know? Absolutely.
Be okay with player death, laugh it off, and, you know, have somebody else to slide right in. So,
and it worked really well with pre-gens because we didn't have any emotional attachment to any of those characters. They weren't our pre-gens. It was just a big pile of people that had been downloaded.
Yep, fair enough. Well, hey, we were heading towards the top of the hour. We have been talking adventure writing for now 30 minutes with just one small unfortunate segue.
That was awesome. Do you want me to cut that for you?
It's fine. We haven't edited things We haven't edited things for the last 10 years of this podcast. I would hate to break our record and start now.
So. Damn, but, skippy.
But if the trolls out there are listening, do it again and we'll start editing you. So don't think this is suddenly fertile ground for.
Or make it really funny and worthwhile being on the podcast.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Impress us.
Oh, and any closing thoughts on the subject of adventure writing and not the subject of back rubs?
Think about what the rewards for successful adventure are and what the consequences for a failed one. We talked about player death, but that doesn't have to be it, right? You can run an adventure where it's all about whether or not someone's favorite rec center gets closed down, and every adventure can lead to another adventure. If the rec center does get closed down, your next adventure can be finding a new space for the rec center or finding a new place for everyone to go skateboarding and play basketball. If the rec center doesn't get closed down, is there another area that you all can move into to try and improve the neighborhood? So consequences and rewards and how they link to the next adventure are a great thing to look at while you're building the adventure. But also, especially if you're doing it from home, listen to your players and see what they're interested in and feel free to modify your adventure on the fly.
Hell yeah.
Sounds good. Walt, any closing thoughts?
Roll more dice, you know, because times are tough and getting together with friends is a lot of fun. So roll some dice, make some worlds, tell some stories. It's all fun.
Sounds good. Mr. Danks.
Play more superhero RPGs. I want to see those make a comeback. I feel like there's been a slump lately. I want to see more of that.
Have you seen the Mutants and Masterminds Patreon?
No.
So Mutants and Masterminds from Green Ronin now has a Patreon where they're putting out regular content.
Oh, for third edition?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, with okay. Crystal Frazier and Steve Kenson.
That's very good to see, because releases were kind of scarce there for a while. I'm glad to see they've ramped that up.
There's this interesting middle ground where you can have enough content for a Patreon post and not enough to put out a book. So it was one way to try and get some things in people's hands, but also get a feedback mechanism where Green Ronin can say, what do you guys want to see? So it's sort of an experiment, but I think it's been a huge hit. And I think it is helping to revitalize interest in M&M, which never went away, but you always want more.
Yeah.
Indeed. All right. Well, hey, thanks to everyone for coming out. Owen, Ryan, Walt. Thanks to Jason and Ron and Sparky in the comments. Travis Bennett, I got my eye on you, buddy.
I got to go find this dude now. This guy is like Leroy Jenkins.
Monday, Noon Mountain, we are playing Robert Schwab's Shadow of the Demon Lord with Jason as the GM. Our ongoing series of 1 hour lunchtime beat-em-ups. So come check it out. It's always a good time.
I can't wait to see how Jason is going to handle the exploding rectum spells in this.
It's a great system, but it is very Schwabian.
I can't wait.
That's
Jason. It's going to be great.
Nice. All right. And that is the top of the hour. Thanks, everybody, for coming out. Thanks to our guests. Thanks to our commenters. Thank you, dear listener or viewer, for checking us out. And we will catch you next time on the Vamp Podcast.
Bye, folks.
Boom.